So this is continuing from 5 years ago with Sir Martin Ryle on 8th June 1981, and mainly just a whole series of follow-up questions from that interview.
2 days and 36 years since D-Day.
Mm. That's right. You might be happy or maybe not that I did note D-Day a couple of days ago. I was born 11 days after D-Day, I might mention, so it's easy for me to remember when it happened. But in your talk that you gave here to the Radio Astronomy Lunch a couple of months ago, you mentioned that you went on an exercise after the war of some kind. And I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about that, where you went over to the continent.
Yes, well, 12 of us went over as observers while the entire North German defense system was kept in action, right up from the radar stations through to the the group command.
With Germans manning it, or?
Oh, sure, yes, right up to the German air marshals. And the idea was to observe what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bomber Command did a series of typical raids using the full works of the devices we'd invented to stop them working. And it was spooky, because to find yourself in a control room in the first instance full of these bloody swastikas was strange, and even more so on the Sydney Island in Denmark, where there was 350 Luftwaffe men associated with this very extensive radar station, where I spent most of my three people spent most of the operations, just actually observing how the guys reacted,
mm-hmm.
and just how the effectiveness of various different devices. It was done in daytime to avoid accidents on landing and things. And, but the only thing that didn't happen, of course, they didn't let German night gliders fly, so we couldn't test all the systems.
Right. Did you get any ideas about picking up equipment for later research while you were over there? Was it?
Oh, well, yes, but I knew most of it anyway.
Yeah, right. So this wasn't really that relevant to the radio astronomy to follow.
It was to a certain extent, because it showed which devices would immediately be useful. And it did certainly influence the selection of bits and pieces which we picked up at the end of the war.
Now, you mean which German devices?
Oh, I'm talking about German devices.
Right, yeah. Well, okay, let me follow on then, saying that, once again, in your talk, you said that the German equipment was easier to get than the British equipment because it didn't have the numbers on it, and they couldn't follow it in inventory and so forth. Was that tongue-in-cheek, or was there really some truth in that?
Well, although I think the point is that any British equipment, you had to get approval from somebody who wasn't wanted anymore.
Right.
Well, the German equipment must have been looked at and examined and everything measured about it. Obviously, it wasn't any use to anybody. And much of it was indeed sold to scrap merchants and people like that. And
right.
So, it is true that there was no sort of stores procedure for coping with it.
Right.
And
right.
So it was much easier to get hold of. But virtually nobody except me that was coming back to university knew what all this stuff was. And so we could put a pick of it. Well,
right.
I never knew what the code numbers meant.
Right. well, along that line, you told the anecdote in your talk, which you also told me 5 years ago, about going down to near Farnborough and picking up all this equipment and the story with the scrap merchant and so forth. But you said you came back with five truckloads, I believe, of equipment. Can you just give me an idea of what was in all this?
Well, there was one giant Wurzburg, the 27-foot diameter.
Which wasn't mounted for several years, I guess.
It wasn't mounted properly as a alt-azimuth machine. It was used, I think I saw a photograph you had just now, as an interferometer, transit interferometer.
Mm-hmm.
That was mounted fairly early on, but it was not finally mounted until we moved to Lord's Bridge as a fully steerable machine. But we also got a large amount of... we also had two small Wurzburgs, and I took one, the one that was captured at Bunavar, which was the ones used by Stanley in his early measurements, 660 centimetres.
Now, what was the diameter actually of those small ones?
9 foot.
9 foot, I see.
Well, we talked in feet in those days.
Right. So about 3 meters, huh?
Yes.
And...
They were mobile, they were on wheels, they could turn behind a truck, and so they were nice to push around.
And they had their mounting right with them, I suppose?
Yes, they were fully mounted. I mean, they were in effect operated by two operators in azimuth and elevation, or three, I think, maybe a range one, who kept the thing on target and the stuff. Then went by magnetic drives to a display, and they were used for various things, the searchlight controls and range measuring, anti-aircraft gun. You can measure the angular position very accurately optically if you catch them in the searchlight beam, but the range is always pretty inaccurate.
Right.
Well, the trouble with anti-aircraft, anyway, only important in the first bit of the war.
What else did you bring back?
Well, then there was a whole load of this very low-loss air cord capture cable, this sort of size, which...
About an inch diameter?
No, more than that. No. It was
2 inches?
Inch and a half, I'd say. Well, inch and a half outside. It had some armoring on it. And these were part of... Well, there were two systems which used phased arrays. Two German systems used phased arrays. And therefore, they had to have a whole collection of cables of precisely the same length.
Mm-hmm.
And they were indeed accurate to a centimeter or so. And these are very valuable. Because there was no symbol.